Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Neil Ferguson, who is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University, a Senior Research Fellow of Jesus College, Oxford University, and a Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution. His new book is The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West. Neil, welcome back to our program.
It's nice to be back, Harry.
When did you conceive the idea of this book?
It was about 10 years ago. I think I went back and checked. There was a proposal for a book that was going to be concerned with World War II, but also with ethnic conflict in Central and Eastern Europe. And in the intervening period, I did a few other things, but the project rolled on. I kept gathering material and accumulating photocopies in the way that one does, always thinking how best to turn this into a viable project. And in the last, I guess, 18 months, it came together very fast, mm-hmm. partly because I turned it into a television series in Britain, which I hope will be shown in the US at some point, but also because I had a book deadline. Mm-hmm. So there was a frantic writing period, but I was writing up stuff I'd been thinking about and teaching mm-hmm. for really quite a long time.
And does the actual writing, just come naturally after you've dug in and done the research?
Pretty much. I mean, I think thinking is the hardest bit about doing history. That there's a certain easiness about just absorbing lots and lots and lots of material. And when I looked at my shelves, I suppose just before I started writing, I lined all the material up and I'd sort of sorted it into roughly the boxes I wanted it in. And I had some of it in electronic format. You know how these things are. At some level, historians are beachcombers who just go around picking stuff up and they carry it around in the equivalent of lots and lots of plastic bags. But when I lined all the material up, I was rather daunted because I'd accumulated a lot over the years. Getting that raw material into a structure is the hard bit. Mm-hmm. And one of the advantages of using television as a medium is that you're forced to get the structure right. Mm. Because there's not actually that many words in an hour of television. Once you've boiled it down into 6 hours, mm-hmm. you've got a structure which is pretty robust, mainly because you've redrafted the script 20 times. Mm. And so once that's done, the writing of the book, which in a sense fleshes out this skeletal structure, is very straightforward. I mean, it's all in there. You just have to mm-hmm. have enough hours in the day to get it down.
It's a big book, and so let me give you an exam question. Could you very briefly state the main thesis of the whole book, and then we'll break that apart?
Sure. Well, The War of the World itself needs some explanation mm-hmm. as a title. It's an allusion, obviously, to H.G. Wells' science fiction classic, The War of the Worlds, which has had many movie and indeed radio reincarnations. And the central theme is that what Wells imagined happening, that's to say a city laid waste by hostile invaders with very powerful weaponry, did in fact happen. It's just that we didn't need Martians to invade the Earth for London to be bombed mm-hmm. to rubble. We had other human beings to do it. And so the question is, why was it that in the 20th century there was so much violence of the sort Wells imagined, so many cities devastated, so many populations laid waste, without any need for alien invaders? Why were we the aliens? Why did we treat other human beings as aliens? That's the sort of central question the book asks. So it's a kind of answer to the question, why was the 20th century so violent, to put it very crudely, an attempt to resolve a paradox, since the 20th century was also the most extraordinary century in terms of economic, scientific, and other forms of progress. Now, having posed the question that way, why so much violence amid so much progress, I then had to break it down. And I broke it down by saying, okay, 20th century violence isn't evenly distributed. It's really heavily concentrated in certain places at certain times. For example, Ukraine is not a great place to be born in, say, 1904. Your chances of dying a violent death, particularly if you're a male, are fantastically high. Whereas I was born in Scotland in 1964, and nobody's fired a bullet at me to date. And that seems to me to be a really important insight. All the previous explanations I knew of to try to unravel the violence of the 20th century couldn't help me with timing or with location. Mm-hmm. They were all far too general. You know, it was the technology, or wicked leaders, or evil and extreme ideologies. None of these things tell you why Ukraine is more dangerous than Scotland and why 1904 is more dangerous than 1964. So the book has a very simple three-part answer to this question. It says really this, that there are three things that help you identify the timing and location of very extreme violent events. One is economic volatility. It's the really economically bumpy times that tend to coincide with violence. The second is ethnic disintegration. It's multi-ethnic societies that are the most dangerous ones. When they tear one another apart, you get much, much more violence than elsewhere. And finally, it's when empires decline that violence is most likely to escalate. And many, many empires declined and fell in the course of the 20th century. I think it was about 12 in all. So there you have a sort of three-part answer, and you'll notice that each of my parts begins with the letter E, which, from my point of view, makes it much easier to remember.
Easier to place it on the bookstore bookshelf, yeah.
Well, it's just it's an aide de mémoire, because if I'm trying to answer a question as difficult as that on a regular basis, it helps to have a mnemonic.
Mm-hmm. Now, you touched just a moment ago on what you discovered with ethnic conflict, and namely there were trends toward assimilation of communities. For example, the Jewish community in Germany before, you know, the downfall came. So let's go beyond that now, because what you're seeing as you look at ethnic conflict is a lot of movement of peoples in this area that you've identified. So there are people moving, people falling under the rule of different empires. Talk a little about that, because these were the factors that, among others, led to the disintegration which began to happen.
Yes, I wanted to write a book that had World War II at its core, and of course that includes the Holocaust. But I realized I couldn't really explain those things if I didn't go right back to the beginning of the century and what I've called the first age of globalization. Because in the first age of globalization, you get extraordinary mobility, unprecedented mobility. People are moving in their millions around the world in a way that they never had before. And that includes enormous migrations from the Pale of Settlement, as it was known, in Russian-controlled Eastern Europe, to which Jews had been confined under Tsarist rule, westwards, not only to the United States, but in many cases simply to Western or Central Europe. Now, these mass migrations are fascinating, not least because they're part of an extraordinary period of economic prosperity, but they're also associated with a dissolution of traditional religious communities. If you go back into the 19th century, certainly the mid-19th century, religious communities are quite sealed off from one another. I mean, decisions about marriage, which is for me, a very, very important indicator, are quite strictly controlled. By 1900, these structures of, if you like, communal control of marital decisions are breaking down. Mm-hmm. Because in the big cities that interest me the most, these cosmopolitan cities, whether you're talking about, Vienna, Budapest, Berlin, Hamburg, places where the great migrations lead people to, structures of religious observance are weakened, just because people are on the move, and also because they're meeting what we used to call the other. They're meeting people from different communities, and human beings are all members of one species, all pretty much sexually compatible. Stuff happens. In other words, what happens is that people start to make romantic decisions, sexual decisions, marital decisions, beyond the control of their religious leaders. And that's really quite new. So you get, from virtually nothing, a sudden upsurge in rates of intermarriage in Central and East European cities. And that was what I first started tracking. And I was really stunned by what I found, because I found that in the 1920s, in some cities, Hamburg was the one I knew best, one in every two marriages involving at least one Jewish partner was mixed. And the rate was even higher in Trieste. It wasn't that far below in a city like Breslau. And the more I looked for this kind of data, which isn't very easy to find, I should say, I mean, I was digging around in dusty old censuses trying to find out who married whom. the more amazed I was. In post-revolutionary Russia, there was a huge upsurge in marriage between Jews and non-Jews. And there were a few countries where this didn't happen. Poland, it didn't happen anything like so much in. So I was left with a question in my mind, and the question was, what went wrong? What went wrong with this process of assimilation and integration, which in the 1920s made many German Jewish leaders think that their community was simply going to dissolve? I mean, there was going to be a dissolution of the Jewish question because everybody essentially was going to marry out. Now, when you have that question being posed in the 1920s, how on earth do you get, within a few short years, to genocide? And that's really one of the central questions that the book asks.
And I recall that you, because what becomes a key element here is not only the movement of the Jews and other nationalities as these changes were, but Germans moving east, basically. And you actually note at a point that the Jews and the Germans got along pretty well, actually, as they were dispersed in the east before the rise of the Nazis.
Well, this region was the region that I was most fascinated by. There's a kind of crescent of territory that runs down from the Baltic Sea through Central Eastern Europe, down into parts of Romania, and then as far east as the River Volga, of German settlement. Some of it dating back to medieval times, some of it as recent as the 18th century. And in these areas, beyond the borders of the Germany Bismarck created, Germans were very often a minority. They were often a dominant minority. They might be the landowners in the Baltic states or the prosperous farmers in Transylvania, but they were clearly a relative minority surrounded by various different kinds of Slavic peasantry. And so interestingly, in around 1900, if you'd gone to somewhere like Chernowitz, a town I became fascinated by, Germans and Jews were, in a sense, partners because they were both German-speaking and they were both minorities. You would tend to find the German Gentiles running the bureaucracy and the German Jews running the university, but they really weren't deeply separated. In fact, they were a more or less inseparable social elite. And that, to me, is fascinating because those sorts of communities existed all over Eastern Europe. Prague is another good example, a place that is essentially run by German speakers, many of them Jewish, in what you might call a sort of Czech sea of peasantry. And it's those places that go wrong. They're the ones that break down. Those relationships between the two minorities, the Jews on the one hand and the Germans on the other, those are the things that malfunctioned so disastrously in the 1930s and 1940s. And I wanted to try and explain that because I don't think it's really been explained before.
And let's talk about what some of those factors were. But one of the points that moves to your second point of analysis is what we were witnessing during this period is the breakdown of the old kind of multinational empire, which governed in a way, I almost get the sense of kind of being laid back, a kind of tolerance of different communities and creating a situation where they could live side by side, although developments then led to a different hierarchies, which became a problem.
This, I think, is why the breakdown of empire is an integral part of the story. Clearly, there were multi-ethnic communities in North America. This wasn't unique to Central and Eastern Europe. New York was one of the cities with the largest immigrant Jewish population in the world, actually, in 1900. But in a sense, New York doesn't become one of the killing fields of the 20th century. Why not? Well, the answer is that it's very far from the kind of imperial fault lines that interest me. The trouble about Central and Eastern Europe was that it was the place where multiple empires met. It's the sort of fault line between Romanov Russian Empire, Habsburg Austrian Empire, Ottoman Turkish Empire, and Hohenzollern Prussian Empire. Four great empires, all bumping up against one another, rather like tectonic plates before an earthquake. Now, in these empires, which were, by definition, more or less multinational, very large, encompassing huge tracts of land, minorities enjoyed a certain security because, A, these empires weren't capable of totalitarian-type control of their subjects. They were really relied on delegated authority to local elites. And B, because they were cosmopolitan and multi-ethnic, there wasn't a sense in which minorities were, as it were, anomalous. There were a great many minorities in the Habsburg Empire. And in some ways, the people running it were a minority, the German speakers of Vienna. So I guess one of the hypotheses of the book is that for all their undoubted flaws, these empires may in fact have been preferable to what succeeded them after the First World War, namely a whole complex of nation states that were essentially based on the principle of majority rule, and in which minorities were much less secure and much more likely to be persecuted. So the end of empire in Central and Eastern Europe spells trouble for ethnic minorities. And that case I mentioned earlier of Chernowitz illustrates the point quite well, because very shortly after the end of the First World War, Romanians are storming around central Chernowitz, proclaiming that it's now Chernauti, a Romanian city, that the German civil servants have to hop it, because now you have to speak Romanian to be a civil servant, and the German professors and German Jewish professors have to hop it, because now the language of instruction will be Romanian. It's deeply traumatic to be on the receiving end of that if you have been the ruling elite of a town. And I think that kind of pattern replicated itself in towns all over Central and Eastern Europe after the First World War.
You make an interesting point, which I want to play with right now, and that is that the technologies, the instruments of consolidation, of bringing order to an empire, had within them the seeds of the disintegration of the empire. And you talk especially about the railroads, and it actually, what it reminded me of was the internet today. That is, that you're dealing with the problem of, well, how does the world find order? And empires have done some of that, but talk a little about the railroads, because they were a way to unite different parts of the empire, but they became something else.
Right. I mean, I spend a lot of time on railroads doing this project, including a stretch of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and it became almost the leitmotif of the project. Because railroads at the beginning of the 20th century looked like instruments of power. The Russian state built railroads with great enthusiasm in order to mobilize its army more effectively. I mean, a lot of railroads went westwards from central Russia towards the Prussian and Austrian frontier for a very obvious reason, and it wasn't trade. So as an instrument of power politics, railroads were crucial, and that's, of course, why, in some measure, we can understand 1914 as, in A.J.P. Taylor's famous phrase, a war by timetable, in which the outbreak of war is in many ways inseparable from the exigencies of railway timetables, getting your troops into position in time before the other guys do. And yet, already, even before 1914, it was becoming obvious that railways had, as it were, an alternative and rather subversive role for an empire like Russia's. One of the most interesting things about the 1905 revolution in Russia, the first real tremor that shakes the Tsarist system, is how the revolution spread along railroads. And it was often in railway towns that unrest first occurred. That was also interestingly where pogroms happened. And the interaction of revolutionary activity and anti-Semitic activity is one of the things that makes 1905 very, very interesting, a harbinger of what lies ahead. I mean, people are simultaneously protesting against Tsarist incompetence in the Russo-Japanese War and beating up or even murdering local Jews as if they're in some sense to blame for foreign defeat. So there's a very, very subtle process going on. It turns out that railways aren't just for transporting troops. They can also transport seditious ideas. It's clear that the notion that the Jews were in some ways to blame spreads along railway lines, and the notion that they've beaten up the Jews in town X is reported in town Y, and it, so to speak, comes along the railway line and happens there. So railways have that role, and they play, of course, another role altogether, an even more horrific role, in the interwar period, when they become the means of transporting ethnic minorities to their deaths. Mm. We all think of cattle trucks in connection with the Holocaust, but actually the Germans were latecomers to this technique because the Turks had used railroads to transport Armenians to the deserts of Syria, and Stalin had used cattle trucks to transport ethnic minorities all over the Soviet Union if he didn't trust them. So railways are very much a kind of key part of this story, and they are transformed from instruments of warfare, modes of transport for commerce, into revolutionary conduits, and ultimately into engines of genocide.
Now, the third component of your analysis is looking at economic volatility during this period. And I think you're suggesting that at some points in their evolution, you know, empires bring a kind of economic stability because integration is recurring within
right.
them. But the larger global events during this period become near catastrophic. As Germany has to repay its World War I debts. Talk a little about that, because it's the third component of what you're trying to say.
Yes, economic volatility is a really important concept, partly because it reminds us that ups can be destabilizing as well as downs. And what I'm interested in when I talk about volatility is precisely the frequency and amplitude of economic change. And we've kind of forgotten what it's like to be in a recession. I mean, the last 10 or so years have been among the most smoothly run, least volatile periods in all economic history, particularly in the United States, but also in Western Europe. But it wasn't like this in the early 20th century, and it certainly wasn't like this in the mid-20th century, when growth would fluctuate very violently from huge booms to sudden dramatic busts, the most famous, of course, being the Great Depression. And my argument is that helps us with the timing of extreme violence. There's no doubt that a multi-ethnic society comes under great strain when volatility surges. Even in good times, you get complaints about who benefits from what we would now call globalization. I mean, the benefits aren't evenly distributed of rapid growth in, say, Tsarist Russia or in Turkey. They're actually quite often skewed towards ethnic minorities who tend to be taking advantage more successfully of the economic opportunities of a global economy. And then along come the bad times, and that's the moment at which the majority may turn around and say, look, the scapegoats are there in the big fancy houses, the people who made the money in the good times. So I think volatility is critical for our understanding of why a multi-ethnic society can tear itself apart. In relatively stable times, neighbors may live quite peacefully next door to neighbors of a different ethnic or sectarian group. But when things are all over the map economically, those relations are likely, I think, to become strained. And I think the book shows that quite convincingly. It helps us certainly to understand the timing of violence. It was much more likely to happen in, say, the 1930s and 40s than in any previous or succeeding decade.
Mm-hmm. I read the book in its entirety, and I really recommend it because it's a remarkable capacity to put pieces of the story together in one, you know, larger context. And when I was going over my notes in preparation for the interview, it dawned on me when we get to World War II and the causes of that war, what you're really showing us is that new kinds of empires emerged with the collapse as these multinational empires were collapsing. They were really state empires that sought to resolve internal problems and reshape the world. Is that a fair restatement of what you're getting at? Because it's very clear that when you look at Germany and Japan, they're dealing with a set of problems. They're going to use their foreign policy to achieve it. They're going to use military power. Talk a little about that, because this was almost like a second iteration of trying to bring order to the world.
What's interesting about these new empire states, as I call them, whether you look at the Soviet Union, which was one, the Third Reich, Nazi Germany, which was another, Nationalist Japan, which was a third, is that they are unquestionably imperial in their dimensions. I mean, they aspire to control large tracts of land inhabited by foreign peoples. So there's no question of their being ethnically homogenous. On the other hand, they tend to try to govern themselves far more like nation states. They're far more centralized, and the insistence on uniformity is far greater. So they're far less tolerant of ethnic minorities than these old empires I was talking about before. So the new empire states are really very dangerous things. They're capable of tremendous internal violence against their own people. They're also capable of extraordinary external violence. They're extremely aggressive. And this, of course, comes down to that critical question of living space that was posed by writers on geopolitics in the mid-century. There was this sense, particularly in Japan and Germany, densely populated societies with, by comparison with, say, the United States or the British Empire, very little free territory. There's a sense in which, and it's not an implausible argument in the 1930s, that to cope with the Depression, Germans and Japanese need more land. And so that the whole project becomes an imperial one, but it's an imperial one which is, I think, more ruthless than previous imperial projects, because the conception is we want the land. We don't really want the people who are currently there. And so the imperial projects that emerge for a thousand-year Reich in Central Europe and Eastern Europe and for a greater East Asia co-prosperity zone imply not only living space but also killing space. You are going to get rid of at least some of the indigenous peoples in order to clear the way for your own master race to reproduce and cultivate. I think that makes these empires really quite distinct from previous empires. They're very much more systematically violent, if you like, much more determined to engage in mass murder than previous empires had been.
And they have the capacity to do that. I mean, they in a sense, industrialize genocide.
Yes, I mean, this is, of course, a critical point, that the countries that do many of the worst things in the mid-20th century are among the most sophisticated in the world. I mean, you can't say that higher education inoculates a society against barbarism, because Germany in the 1920s had the best universities in the world. Bar none, and a very high proportion of Nobel Prizes were being awarded to Germans from these universities.
More than in the United States.
More than in the United States, which was significantly behind. And indeed, Germany was really where you went if you had scientific ambitions at that time. So we have a puzzle here, which is that really the most sophisticated societies produce the greatest barbarism. Japan, too, clearly the most advanced Asian society in the 1920s, capable, as Germany was, of running a democratic system, and yet able to unleash, within a few short years, extraordinary levels of organized violence, waged very ruthlessly, in the sense that there was never any restraint in the way that violence was used by these empire states when they let rip. And indeed, the lack of restraint, the ruthlessness, was almost a signature of both regimes. There was a sense that the traditional restraints on the conduct of war were suspended when Japan went into, say, Nanjing, or when the Germans invaded Poland. The gloves were off. And I think one of the things that's most troubling about the book is the idea that it's highly educated men who are often responsible for the worst atrocities. We can't pretend that there's some kind of lower middle class affair, because Nazism is essentially devised and implemented by people with doctorates, with very high levels of education.
And I recall a footnote in which the there were a high number of PhDs that were head of these killing units that went in the first wave of the German invasion.
The SS was an elite organization. Yeah. It attracted specialists in racial theory and eugenics. And we forget now that these disciplines have been completely discredited, that they were or seemed to be at the cutting edge of modern science in the 1920s and 1930s, and people who specialized in racial theory held eminent posts in universities, not only in Germany, but in the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So these people were natural recruits to a project to redraw the ethnographic map of Europe. Hitler was, of course, not a very well-educated man. He was an autodidact with very incoherent ideas. But when it came to turning Hitler's diffuse aversion to Jews and his paranoia about miscegenation into policy, you turned to these people, and they came from the universities, donned their black uniforms, and perpetrated horrific crimes, as if their education had, in a sense, stripped them of moral restraint rather than equipping them with it.
And racial theory becomes a key component of this, that for example, the Jews pollute the blood of the Aryan race and so on and so forth. I mean, that's a key element in, a key plank in the, I think you call it a political religion, that Hitler came to power on. And as you point out, he headed a mass movement. And he was he did win large numbers of if not a plurality, I think, in the voting.
On the question, he should probably have formed a government earlier than he did, actually, because the Nazi victory in 1932 is really decisive, and it's only by some rather footloose play that they can keep Hitler out of power until 1933. Mm-hmm. There's no question that Hitler articulates popular feelings. Not a majority. Mm-hmm. You need a majority. This was a PR system, and with proportional representation, the Nazis clearly were in a position to form a government by 1932. But he articulates the feelings of a very large number of Germans. One of the things that I was able to show in the book is that if you take all the people who ever voted for a fascist party, in Europe, in the period of the Depression, an overwhelming majority of them were German speakers. And this is true not only in the German Reich, but it's also true when you look at Austria and look in countries like Czechoslovakia. So in a sense, as a mass movement, fascism was a quite peculiarly German one. Other fascist parties didn't do anything like as well. There were very, very few fascist parties that could mobilize the way the Nazis could. And so part of the question is, how far is anti-Semitism what makes Hitler popular? Or is it, in a sense, a kind of cranky preoccupation of the extremists in the party? Now, it's tempting to say it's a marginal phenomenon. Hitler doesn't talk about it that much in 32, 33. It's essentially an economic protest vote that the Nazis capitalize on, or it's an anti-Versailles, anti-peace treaty vote. And yet, when you look at how often the themes of what became Nazi government propaganda were present in the popular culture of Weimar Germany in the 1920s, you have to wonder. I mean, for example, one of the great bestsellers of the early 20s was a book called The Sin Against the Blood by a guy called Arthur Dinter. And this book is an absolutely classic Hitlerian fantasy about, quote, racial pollution. And when Hitler says in Mein Kampf that the Jews pollute the blood of the Aryans, he means something quite specific. He's talking about intermarriage and sexual relations between Jews and non-Jews. And, of course, he's actually talking about something that, as we said earlier, was happening. It's not in that sense an imaginary construct. But it translates this high level of intermarriage into an anxiety which Hitler is not alone in feeling, that something is changing, as it were, in German society, that something is fundamentally being altered by this pattern of assimilation and integration. And what's interesting is the extent to which these ideas are imported from places like the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, Germans had never really been worried about race before because, in a sense, they'd not been part of the great imperial projects of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Now, in the English-speaking world, fear of miscegenation, fear of intermarriage across racial boundaries was very well established and had produced anti-miscegenation laws in a very large number of American states. So it's taking ideas from outside the German world and importing them and applying them to the particular predicament of Central Europe in the 1930s, I think is a very, very potent appeal that those ideas turn out to have. It's not just the cranks, in other words, but highly educated men with PhDs who come to believe that the Jews are a, quote, racial tuberculosis or some kind of parasitical body that has to be expelled from the German folk. Now, once you've got highly intelligent, highly educated and well-equipped Germans believing that, you can go an awful lot further than with pogroms in Russia in 1905. You can go all the way down the railroad track, ultimately to Auschwitz.
I'm going to show your book again, and I want to segue into the present. You cover a lot, and we have only an hour. And to segue into the present, I want to focus on a point you make about the British response to the Nazis And I culled from what you were saying 2 points. One, that Chamberlain's government misperceived when they could have actually acted against Hitler and stopped him, on the one hand.
Yeah.
And then secondly, that the British military understood that it was caught between a rock and a hard place. That is, the security of the British Isles and being able to stop Hitler on the continent on the one hand, and then protecting the empire, and that they could not do both. So in both cases, these were important issues that affect the outcome, you know, as we were leading up to war. And they really have implications for today, the insights.
Yeah, I think that they do, although one has to be very, very careful about drawing any kind of analogies with the 1930s. It's done much too readily today. I hear, once again, terms like appeasement being trotted out by Secretary Rumsfeld. We hear this extraordinary neologism, Islamofascism, to characterize terrorists. I'm very skeptical about these analogies. What I argue in the book is that in 1938, there was a tremendous opportunity to stop Hitler early, because Hitler took a huge risk over Czechoslovakia by threatening to go to war on behalf of the German-speaking minority in the Sudetenland. If Britain, France, and conceivably also the Soviet Union had called Hitler's bluff and forced a confrontation, either he would have had to back down, or he would have had to wage a war in a very vulnerable situation. Because Germany was not ready for war, his military commanders told him that. They would have been fighting not only the Czech army, but they would have had to defend their borders in east and west against potential intervention. Germany's economic position was not very secure, and Hitler's domestic position was in some ways quite flaky at this point. It was a fantastic opportunity to stop him in his tracks, and it was missed, I think, in large measure because Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and the people around him completely underestimated Hitler's vulnerability and exaggerated what they would gain from another 12 months of peace. And this was the fatal mistake. They said to themselves, we're not quite ready for war, or we don't have enough fighter planes. The Germans may be able to bomb London, and indeed they exaggerated that threat quite seriously. What we need is time. If we only had time, we could be more ready for war than we are right now. So let's just do whatever it takes, including selling the Czechs down the river, to get another 12 months. What they fail to realize, it's a kind of elementary mistake, but a profound one, is that 12 months also gets given to Hitler under those circumstances. And with those 12 months, Hitler did much more to secure his position than they were able to do. In particular, Hitler strikes his deal with Stalin, which completely secures Germany's eastern frontier. Mm-hmm. Now, once that happens, the war breaks out on a basis far more disadvantageous to the Western powers than it would have been in 1938. So I see 1938 really, in rather Churchillian terms, as a huge missed opportunity. Instead of flying, as he did, three times to Germany to appease Hitler, Chamberlain should have stopped taking Hitler's calls and essentially said, bring it on. I hesitate to use that phrase, but he should certainly have called Hitler's bluff, because I think either Hitler would have gone ahead and found himself in a war that would have been quite hard to win, or he would have had to fold, and that would have damaged his prestige pretty badly. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I used the phrase bring it on deliberately because there's a potential inference you could draw from this. You could say here's an argument for preemption, that in fact what was needed against Nazi Germany was action sooner rather than later, and that leaving it until 39 made matters a great deal worse because by 39 the dictator was stronger. Now, you could make arguments about the Middle East that follow a similar pattern. Mm-hmm. Though, as I've said, you have to be very careful. Mm-hmm. There are no Hitlers in the Middle East. Saddam was not Hitler. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is not Hitler. These are very much lesser mortals, if you like, certainly less dangerous regimes. On the other hand, when you start talking about nuclear weapons, you enter even more dangerous territory than Britain was in the 30s. I mean, Goering had the Luftwaffe, even the Luftwaffe's bombers weren't particularly large. He was a long way from even the possibility of a nuclear weapon. So there are some pretty big strategic lessons to be learned from the 30s. We just have to be quite careful how we go about learning them, because these analogies are not perfect. And Iran clearly isn't the Third Reich, to take
now, what about this conflict between the requirements of protecting the British Isles versus the protecting the empire?
Yes, I mean, this is one of the ways in which the situation is really very different in the 30s, that the great English-speaking empire has vast commitments, territorial commitments and military commitments on the other side of the world. And as they sit down and review their strategic options, British decision makers have a problem in their hands, because they're vastly in excess of what Britain's military can possibly defend. The obvious case being the Singapore military base, which was supposed to be a new strong point for British power in Asia, with the potential for a very substantial naval presence that would notionally deter Japan or anybody else from attacking British assets, but which was in fact indefensible in the event of a European war, because you couldn't possibly send the ships there that you would need in home waters. So British strategy is, to use Paul Kennedy's famous phrase, a function of overstretch. They do not have the financial resources to defend all these places at once. They know it. So they have to just sit there and hope that they don't get hit by the perfect storm. And the perfect storm is simultaneous German, Japanese and Italian attack. And of course, they do. And that illustrates, I think, the danger of hoping that the worst case scenario won't happen, because by and large, if you just hope that, it generally does.
So if you look around the world today, what region seems to have this mix of elements that are at the core of your analysis of this earlier period?
So I had an epiphany as I was concluding the book. I remember sitting down and thinking, okay, well, I think I understand now why Central and Eastern Europe and Manchuria, Korea in Asia were such dangerous places. Mm-hmm. It's economic volatility, it's ethnic disintegration, it's empires in decline. Why does that seem strangely familiar? Where could that possibly be said today? And there's an obvious answer, because the Middle East today has all three of those elements in place already. I mean, economic volatility, I worked it out. It's been sort of four or five times more volatile than the U.S. economy over the past 20 years. Ethnic disintegration, well, what's happening in Baghdad and central Iraq as Sunni and Shiite Iraqis kill one another is an almost perfect illustration of the kind of cycle of ethnic violence I describe in the book. And you've got an empire in decline. The United States, which had a hegemonic position in the Middle East, certainly in the mid-1970s, is now incapable of managing what, by 19th century standards, is a relatively small colonial operation to try and stabilize Iraq, and looks potentially like a busted flush in nuclear non-proliferation. It's not great to have those three things simultaneously happening in a region. And my fear is that far from our having a clash of civilizations on our hands between Islam and the West, what we actually face is a huge clash within civilization, i.e. within Islam, between Sunnis and Shias. But more generally, it seems to me, this has the potential to escalate beyond Iraq's borders, because many of the countries that border Iraq are ethnically mixed. It's only on the far east that you have largely Shiite Iran, and the far west of the Middle East that you have largely Sunni Egypt. In the middle, you've got a whole bunch of countries that share with Iraq a multi-ethnic character. So the nightmare scenario is that what we're seeing in Baghdad as escalating sectarian conflict could in fact become more widespread. And there, I think, there is a good analogy to be drawn with the 1930s and 1940s. It looks an awful lot like what happened in Central and Eastern Europe. And interestingly, Middle Eastern countries are at roughly the same level of economic development today as places like Poland and Ukraine were back in 1930.
If the hope was in the unipolar moment, as it was referred to in the public debate here in the United States, it was that the American empire, which we deny is an empire, would bring to this part of the world a stability and an order. And I guess one would have to say that the two instruments by that which that would be done would be democratization on the one hand and America's unbalanced technology in the military realm. Your book talks a lot about that, those two instruments, primarily the military instrument as a way to save lives and use capital to win wars, to do all sorts of things. So bring your analysis from the book to what you see as problematic, if you do, in such an effort to bring order to this this region, which you've just described as being very much like the ones you were describing in the other period.
Yes, I suppose the United States, and this is also true of Britain, has this double advantage. I mean, it has a very, very good political system, democracy with the separation of powers, the rule of law, and all of that. And it also has tremendous technological strength in the realm of weaponry as well as in the civilian sphere. And this, of course, makes it both an attractive place and a powerful place. But there's a problem. I mean, one of the problems is that democracies tend to recognize the perils that they face rather late in the day. It's quite hard, in fact, to be an effective preemptor as a democracy, because even if you're right, it's still much harder to persuade people of the legitimacy of a war than if it's a war of retaliation. Preemption just isn't as attractive as lashing out after a Pearl Harbor event. It was extremely hard to persuade Americans that they needed to become involved in World War II. And let's not forget that it is only after Pearl Harbor that they do become involved. And I look at some length at the opinion polls, which tell us fascinating things about Americans, that early on they're quite hostile to the Axis, but they're deeply reluctant to compromise their neutrality and actually fight the Axis. Mm. So that's one problem. And I called it in an earlier book, Colossus, the problem of the attention deficit disorder, the short time horizon of democracies. When they do intervene militarily, they want quick results. They quite rapidly lose patience. So that's one problem about being a democracy. And the problem about being, as it were, a techno-warrior, relying heavily on sophisticated weaponry, is that while it may make you very good at blasting cities from the air, and we've got increasingly good at that since the bludgeon-like strategic bombing of World War II. We've achieved the smart bomb that can fly down the chimney of, oh dear, the Chinese embassy, but it was supposed to be a major Serbian asset. We have, in fact, perfected aerial warfare. The trouble is, we've got so good at that that we've forgotten the rather more old-fashioned form of military activity, which is low-intensity conflict, street-to-street fighting, patrols, curfews, human intelligence. I mean, in a sense, our very strength was our ability to substitute capital for labor. That's what aerial warfare was all about, killing Germans with the minimum number of Allied lives being put on the line. It was tough luck if you were flying one of those bombers, but it was preferable than throwing wave upon wave of infantry divisions against the Axis powers. But the more good you are at that sort of sophisticated warfare, the less good you're likely to be at what might be called post-conflict operations. And I think we're seeing that very clearly in Iraq, that for all its tremendously sophisticated weaponry, the United States turns out to be quite bad at the kind of constabulary duties of empire.
Mm-hmm. As a historian, you must get very frustrated at the extent to which the policy debate distorts history. We mentioned already, you know, the concept of Islamofascist appeasement. You know, all of these very important policy debates get implicated in a distortion of what history demonstrates. Of course, there's always an argument in history, but this goes beyond that. How do we deal with that, basically? Get everybody, besides getting everybody to read your book, but beyond that.
Well, that would help. That would be a good start. Now, I think this is a really important point, because what we see at the moment is an attempt to interpret our present predicament in a rather caricatured World War II idiom. I mean, Islamofascism illustrates the point well, because it's a completely misleading concept. In fact, there's virtually no overlap between the ideology of Al-Qaeda and fascism. It's just a way of making us feel that we're the greatest generation fighting another world war, like the war our fathers and grandfathers fought. Mm-hmm. So you're translating a crisis symbolized by 9/11 into a sort of pseudo-World War II. So 9/11 becomes Pearl Harbor, and then you go after the bad guys who are the fascists, and if you don't support us, then you must be an appeaser. Now, this is really, really misleading, because I don't think, in fact, 9/11 bears the slightest relation to Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. I mean, how long have you got? We could go through it point by point. Yeah. It's clearly something very, very different. And I think this language is being used mendaciously to play on the very strong pull that World War II still has on our emotions. I mean, I'm fascinated by the fact that the most popular computer games among young males include, to an extraordinary extent, World War II games. They're vastly more popular than any other history context game, and they proliferate in a way. I see this in my young son's gaming habits. They're fascinated by Medal of Honor, and I'm trying to persuade them to adopt a more sophisticated game called The Calm and the Storm, which actually is a historically well-informed game. But we are drawn to World War II, and therefore when politicians want to make us feel that we're fighting the good fight, that we're on the side of the angels, they can use World War II era language, and I think distort our predicament. So as a historian, my only possible response to that is to run around writing books and op-eds and doing television interviews, trying to persuade people that Islamofascism is a fantasy. If anything, bin Laden is more like Lenin than he is like Hitler, because he's got a vision of international revolution. He's certainly an anti-capitalist. He would like to undermine the United States partly by economic means. He's very good at recruiting what Lenin used to call useful idiots, too. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of parallel to be drawn, but I think it's more with Bolshevism, pre-1917 Bolshevism, which was in many ways a terrorist network of extreme communists. That's a useful parallel, but of course it has much less moral salience than the Islamo-fascist cliché.
I can't help, because I know that your distinguished career involves a lot of work on international economic institutions and the relation of money to power, to ask you, and how dicey a situation are we today in the international economy? I mean, one has only to think of the U.S. debts, the Chinese surpluses, and the Middle Eastern and other countries producing oil and the wealth that they have. Is this something that in addition to the region of the Middle East fitting your pattern, is this something that we should worry about?
Yes, global imbalances are a fascinating subject. We are in an extraordinary world in which Americans don't save, but finance their exceptionally high living standards by borrowing the savings of much poorer Asians who save upwards of a third, if not a half, of their incomes. Now, this enormous transfer goes through a strange route whereby the People's Bank of China buys American bonds and banknotes and short-term treasury bills.
Approaching $1 trillion now.
It's an astonishing number. Yeah, yeah. You could do an awful lot with that. And yet it sits there in the reserves of the People's Bank of China, earning interest, not a very high rate of interest, which is then duly paid by the United States Treasury. And I think this is a relationship that many Americans are baffled by. It's great as long as it lasts, because these are, in a sense, this is a low interest rate credit facility from the rest of the world to the United States, and it allows Americans to drive bigger cars, own larger houses, and import many, many more cheap electronic goods than they otherwise would be able to. Now, this reminds me of nothing more than the position of the British Empire in its twilight years. For most of its existence, the British Empire was a creditor empire. It lent out the money rather than borrowing it. But after World War II, in fact, during World War II, Britain's empire became an indebted Empire, and indeed it relied very heavily on an overdraft facility from the United States. Now, running an empire when you are a borrower is a different ballgame, mm-hmm. because at some point your creditors may call up and say, we're not sure we like what you're doing, and you better stop doing it, otherwise this credit line is going to be terminated. That happened to Britain in 1956 during the Suez Crisis, when the Eisenhower administration effectively pulled the plug on the British presence in Egypt by saying, we won't support the pound if this continues. At least that was a part of the reason for the collapse of the Suez policy. It's not unimaginable that somewhere down the line the United States could find its own foreign policy room for maneuver limited by its dependence on particularly Asian central banks. We shouldn't forget also that the Middle East, as it accumulates earnings through oil exports, is also part of the source of funding for America's deficit. And so we're in this sort of ghastly situation whereby one of America's principal allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, earns very huge amounts of money from its oil exports and then channels much of that money into Pakistani madrasas where fundamentalist Wahhabist Islam is taught. This is why I coined the phrase the axis of allies to describe the sort of central problem of American strategy at the moment. The real trouble, if you're worried about radical Islam, is actually in your allies' camp rather than among, say, North Korea or for that matter, Iran.
So if China and the U.S. are the two empires, one declining and one emerging, then this is a new twist, this very high interdependence. Although there was high interdependence before World War II, but this is qualitatively of a different level.
It's quantitatively bigger. Yeah. I mean, there's no question that before 1914, the Russian Empire was very heavily dependent on French capital. Mm-hmm. After World War II, the British Empire was very heavily dependent on American mm-hmm. capital. A lot depends on just how relations between China and the United States progress. If they're harmonious and there's a sort of Sino-American friendship, then the deal could be perpetuated for quite some time. It certainly serves China's purposes to have Americans consume by importing exports from China's manufacturing mm-hmm. zone. So it's not as if this is a bad deal from a Chinese point of view. And just in the same way that having a good relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom meant that the decline and fall of Britain's empire was in some measure cushioned. And empires don't decline at the same rate. Mm-hmm. We need to bear that in mind. And one of the points I make in the book is that there's no standard duration for empires. Some are very short-lived, like Hitler's. Some last a very long time, like the Ottoman Empire. Somewhere in the middle you find the European empires. We don't know how long the American Empire, if you will forgive my using that controversial phrase, we don't know how long it will last. We don't know how long the United States will be the dominant power in East Asia. It may even have ceased to be already, because there isn't a standard time frame. Some empires collapse really quickly. My sense is that the United States is going to experience a sort of bumpy downward slope, and it won't be an instantaneous collapse, because the U.S. still has an awful lot going for it as an economy and as a society. It's not very good at governing far away, hot, poor, dangerous countries, but it's good in an awful lot of other things, and that we shouldn't lose sight of.
Neil, on that note, I want to thank you for writing the book, which I will show our audience again and recommend very highly. And so thank you very much for joining us on our program, and thank you for writing the book.
Thank you, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.